Before the sun rises, Mary Magdalene comes to the tomb, and everything changes. The stone is rolled away, the grave is empty, confusion turns to wonder, sorrow gives way to joy. In John chapter 20, verses 1 through 18, we're going to encounter the turning point of all history, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But it's not just an empty tomb that changes everything, it's the voice of the risen Lord calling Mary by name, just as he does each and every one of us. Her tears are met with triumph. She becomes the first to proclaim, "I have seen the Lord." So we're going to look in on how the risen Christ turns despair into hope right now on Thy Strong Word. Good morning, dear saints, and blessed Advent. Today is Tuesday, December 17th, and you're listening to the program where each weekday morning we explore the Holy Scriptures through which God bespeaks us righteous and nourishes our faith. I'm your host, Pastor Phil Boo of St. John Lutheran Church in Luverne, Minnesota. And today, we are pleased to say that Thy Strong Word is underwritten by the Lutheran Heritage Foundation. I'm always happy to say that, and I want you to support them, but not just because they're sponsors of the show, but because of all the great work they do. People all over the world are learning about Jesus and the faith through their own language, because that's the mission of LHF. They translate and provide key Lutheran Christian resources into languages for countries all over the world, so that new believers and church leaders and everybody in between have the tools they need to grow in faith. So visit lhfmissions.org to learn about how you can help share these life-changing books. They provide them free of charge to those who are looking to have outreach ministries. And again, that's lhfmissions.org. Nothing to do left but to go and check them out, and I hope you do. And while you're there, go ahead and send me your questions, comments, or thoughts, or anything you want to say to my email, thystrongword@kfuo.org. And you can also find me on X and on Facebook. I'm on there usually. I don't know. I don't spend as much time on there as some people do, but I'm on there every now and then. All right, let's invite my guest to the show. Have him come up front and center. It's the Reverend John Schenck. He's the pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Edwardsville, Illinois. Pastor Schenck, welcome back.
Well, good morning. God's blessings. Blessed Advent tide to you. And I'm sure you're quite busy getting everything ready for the celebration and the nativity and everything going on. But it's wonderful to be here. It's wonderful to then look at where the birth of Christ is going, the point and purpose of why he is our Emmanuel, God with us.
Indeed. How are you guys celebrating Advent? Anything special or new? Or maybe I should say Christmas, since it's so close.
Yeah, I guess it's not different or not new, but continues to be the same way that Christians have always celebrated the Nativity, maybe at different times or whatever. But yeah, we have church at 5, 7, and 11 on the Christmas Eve and 10 a.m. on Christmas. So if you're in the Edwardsville area, come and and celebrate and sing and have a wonderful candlelight service services with us at Edwardsville.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Absolutely. Edwardsville, Illinois, you have a lot of opportunities there to worship. We only have a few services. We must be a little smaller than you, but it's so nice. Christmas and Easter, of course, is kind of, well, it's very well known among church leaders and pastors that you see a lot of people that you don't see the rest of the year. And you know, I think that's what we've always struggled with in terms of leaders who genuinely want folks to be encountering this gospel message, not just during the big events, but all year long. On the other hand, though, it's hard to get too upset when you see people in worship, and you hope people will see the value in it more often. But yeah, it's sort of an interesting time period where we encounter a lot of people who probably don't think about Christ much during the year.
Yeah, I think if we look back to the biblical accounts of those days, of the birth of Christ, of the resurrection of our Lord, there's not very many people there, as we will study. It's uniquely sparse, and yet the celebration is still packed with heaven. So no matter if you have a bunch of services and they're packed, or it's just a few people gathered in the pews, we're reminded that Christ is the one who calls these people maybe the shepherds, or later on the Magi, or here with Mary Magdalene. He's the one who calls us to see his birth. He is the one who calls us to recognize and hear Jesus call us by name. So no matter the number, it is our Lord doing the calling and doing the saving. So we will rejoice nonetheless, no matter how many people or maybe how few, doesn't matter, because heaven itself is filled with the praise of Christ.
Indeed. Indeed. And that's what we're going to keep in our hearts as we move forward today, because we have just yesterday, walked through John's account of Christ's crucifixion. And we ended that, of course, with him being kind of hastily, it seems, from the text, put in the nearest tomb. Joseph of Arimathea, likely using his own tomb, kind of stores Jesus for a little while. At least that's the impression that I get when I read it from John, that he knows that they're going to have to make some permanent arrangements at some point. They quickly apply spices to the Bible. They put him in a tomb that was nearby. And all of this is predicated in the fact that, you know, they want to get his body down before the Passover. So as we go into our text today, we get to see the other side of that story. We get to see what happens the next morning. And we know that the women are going to the tomb, although the focus in John here is mostly on Mary Magdalene. But the women are going to also prepare Jesus's body. I've always just presumed, and maybe you could have some insight into this, that they just either don't know that it's already kind of been done, or, as is something that we all experience, the women disciples were just like, yeah, no, obviously we're going to have to go and do it the right way. So what do you think? Do you have a dog in that fight? What do you think is the motivation for the women going to the tomb?
I think it's the latter. I really do believe it's the latter, that they know that there's things needed to be done in haste, because the other gospels really make it clear that Mary Magdalene and some of the other women were there. They were there, and they were, you know, either sitting or standing there across from the tomb as all these things were being done, which helps us to understand, you know, how do they know where to go? How do they understand about the stone that had been rolled there? So they know all these details because they were personally there as eyewitnesses of all the events of the crucifixion, all the events then of him being taken down, and then they went and rested on the Sabbath day themselves.
Now, some people have questioned why we only sort of see Mary in John. One of the commentators, or several of them actually, have kind of come out and said, well, one thought, and I want to see if you agree with this or have a different view, is that maybe this isn't the reason why the other women aren't mentioned, is because at this time the women aren't there. Perhaps Mary, separated from the rest of the women, either came early, maybe just a little bit early, maybe a lot early. How do you reckon that? Is this just focusing on Mary's experience and the other women are there but not mentioned? Or is this a separate event? How do we understand Mary kind of coming to the tomb and John just seems to be focusing on her?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I think when you take a look at all the four Gospels together, there are times where it seems hard to harmonize them. And I think there are times where that is helpful, where maybe objections or maybe even accusations of contradictions are laid before Christians' feet, or maybe you have got a friend in the faith that is struggling and saying, you know, they went off to college and they're told that there are thousands and thousands of these contradictions in the Bible. It can't be trusted or whatever. And I think there are times where we can harmonize it. I think there are times where we shouldn't, where we should allow each gospel to just stand alone as its own account, because it's got its own details. And I think there are maybe something in between where we can say the details of each account are not contradictions. Just because they're recording different things doesn't mean that the details themselves are contradictory, where one detail cannot stand with a different detail of a different gospel at the same time and be logically acceptable, right? Here in this gospel, One way to look at it is, like you said, Mary goes earlier. Another way is to say, no, they went to the same time, but because it's Mary and because it's who the other people we have coming up here with Peter and James, it becomes their specific eyewitness account. Not that the other women aren't there, or not that there isn't, you know, the Emmaus disciples or anything else, but we're here speaking about them, and they have a real unique tie together because of the of what happens on that day between these three. And I kind of fall in that line where they're all the women, as many as five or more women are going to the tomb at one time early in the morning. In fact, in John's gospel, it kind of makes it clear that they're going even before the sun has been raised. But as they go, taking the other gospels, the sun is rising. And before they get to the tomb, the sun has begun, or there's a light of the day that has been raised up. But when they get to the tomb, they notice what they've been discussing along the way. I believe that's Mark's gospel, kind of makes it clear that they've been talking about the problem being the stone. How are we going to handle this problem? And when they get, or at least get approaching it, and get near to the tomb, they see the problem that they had, or they thought was the biggest problem, has been removed. The stone has been rolled away. And my thought is that Mary now leaves. She goes with great haste. She runs to the disciples. So that's where I see their separation. I don't see the separate, my take. And I can understand it could be harmonized or it could be slightly different. Maybe they're separated beforehand. But my feeling is that they're separated at this point. But there is a separation between Mary and some of the other women.
No, I think that's all very helpful. And, you know, and for those who don't speak sort of theologian, I can tell you that at the start, Pastor was kind of gently redirecting me, because one of the things that we're always told to do, and it really is important, is to try to resist the urge, though, to bring in a bunch of details from the other gospels, even though those details are important and they are certainly cohesive. When we do that, sometimes, and I think it's right to point out for folks at home, too, sometimes we miss the point that's trying to be made. So I do think it's valuable to kind of say, oh, well, why are we just talking about Mary? But at the same time, yeah, let's not let sort of those unanswered questions distract us from what John is trying to communicate. But I think that is helpful for those who are thinking, hey, you know, what's the deal? As you said, people are going to be confronted with this idea that scripture is not in harmony with itself. And that couldn't be farther from the truth, even when compared to other ancient writings.
Yeah. And there's times where we can jump to the other gospels. Like when we say, okay, well, who is this Mary person? Well, Luke's gospel really helps us over there. You know, in Luke 8, it talks about the women who support Jesus and the disciples financially. And it talks about Mary and how seven spirits, she was released from their oppression or whatever, however you want to say it. So she had this miracle, this healing. God through Christ healed her of this seven spirits. So yeah, it's not that we should create an impenetrable wall between the gospels. I don't mean that at all, that one gospel can't inform the other. But like you said, sometimes we can allow the harmonization of all the gospels kind of muddy the waters, where we just lose the amazing facet nature of this specific. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't or should be afraid, or it can't be done to harmonize. I really do believe it can be done. I was looking at one before our coming on to the radio, and man, this person on their little podcast, they within 5 minutes harmonize them, and it's like, oh yeah, it totally can be done, even though it is difficult, and we might have some differences of opinion, like you said, could they have been separated before, could they have been separated after, the back and forth of the women from the tomb to the disciples, there can be difference of opinion, because we're maybe even supplying some logical answers to the texts that aren't there, even as we look at all four of the gospels, but it doesn't mean that they're contradicting. It doesn't mean that there's different details, so that they can't be one message of all the stories of all the legends together, of this is how Christ was raised, and this is the interaction with all of them throughout. Though I would say, I don't know if it was Nagel or some other theologian I was reading or listening to at some point, where they were kind of pointing out the struggle and reminding us that after Christ has been raised, he doesn't act the same way. You know, just because he's coming, and, you know, you hear it with some certain denominations that have a certain bent about Christ in the flesh, right? After his resurrection, he's on my altar and your altar and around the world all at one time. So that we would not, we don't need to say, well, he's here at this time, but he's over there at that time. So we have to separate the times. We don't anymore have to separate the time. Christ is everywhere in the flesh.
That is so. Yeah, I'm in one of those kind of like right mind blown things, because I obviously believe that, but had never considered that in light of some of these things. You know, and one more thing before we actually read some of the text, one other thing that I also learned, and I think it's hard to communicate to people, so try to hear what I'm saying and not what I'm not saying, at folks at home. But when you have, say, a supposed contradiction in the Bible or something that just doesn't make sense, often if you can, in a reasonable way, make it make sense by sort of inventing the context whereby it would make perfect sense, you probably have it wrong. Don't get me wrong. But the fact that it can be reconciled is proof that it is reconcilable, and we may not always have privy to how it is, but if you can come up with a way to reconcile it, you know, that doesn't involve space aliens or something, then you can say, oh, this is reconcilable. I just don't know how. And I think that's fair. Otherwise, people are saying, well, the Bible is contradicting itself. And what they really mean is, I don't know enough about the Bible, the history, or what's going on to make this make sense. And that's more honest, at least.
Amen. Yeah. And that's what we do with every eyewitness account. Let's, if you go to law school, if you talk about a lawyer or a judge or the instructions to a jury, that's what they would tell us to do. So why wouldn't we do it here? Why does the Bible have a different set of rules that makes it impossible to be true? You know, the world is so prejudiced against the Bible that they would apply a separate rules to the Bible so that they can reject it without complete prejudice compared to a different eyewitness account about, you know, I'll give one example. I was talking to my students just yesterday of trying to explain what a summary is, right? What is a summary? Going over the Lord's Prayer. And so I asked them, what'd you do this weekend? And they would talk about different things and really just kind of mainly only name one thing that they did over the weekend. And I'm like, well, is that all that you did? And then they start naming other things. And I'm like, well, did you name them in order even? They're like, no, I kind of named the most important. So when we talk about, and I didn't say, well, you're contradicting yourself, you're a liar. It's like, no, they're just naming it in the way that they wanted to recount it and to draw out what they thought is the most important thing. And they would draw other details in where it would help their story, right? And they weren't being contradicted, and nor are they being deceitful. And that's the same thing with all of our stories. We try to lay them out in a way that brings the main thing to the forefront, and the other details we'll bring in if it helps bringing the main thing forward.
This is why someone very systematic in his historical approach, like St. Luke, the physician, is going to have a different approach than John, who is trying to tell things in a way that delivers the message. So, yeah, there are different ways to tell the story or to even witness to these real accounts. And I think we're going to see that here in a few minutes. But let's go ahead and get some verses under our belt. I'm going to read from chapter 20 of the Gospel of John. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version, beginning with the first verse through the 10th verse. Here we go. Now, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb early while it was still dark and saw that the stone had been taken away from the tomb. So she ran and she went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to them, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." So Peter went out with the other disciple, and they were going toward the tomb. Both of them were running together, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. And stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came, following him, and went into the tomb, and he saw the linen cloths lying there, and the face cloth which had been on Jesus' head, not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Then the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went in, and he saw and believed. For as yet they did not understand the scripture that he must rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to their homes. Now Mary's going to stay there for a while, or maybe this happened after the next section. We'll talk about that in a minute. But obviously we got to talk about this race, right? John wants to make it very clear that he reached there first. Is there a theological argument here beyond maybe him just slipping it in? I don't know. I know I'm being influenced by the very popular meme that's out there, but it's so true. It does feel kind of like, yeah, you know, I beat the old man. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, getting to be an older man myself, and my son is passing me by, not only in height, but definitely in his ability to run. He's a cross-country runner, and he would get there way before I would. And it would not be a problem. I think we see some respect there, or position, maybe even fear on John's part. I don't know. I'm applying too much my own thoughts there. But he stays on the outside, and Peter, the ever eager one, goes in. And I mean, there's just so much detail here. It's mind blowing, right? That all this happens while it's still dark. You know, that it's in the morning, but there is darkness. In John's gospel, that's always a big deal. From the first chapter, right, where that light has come and shining in the darkness, the darkness has not overcome it, to Nicodemus, to the storms in the middle of the night, we're on the sea, to here, where darkness is always a sign of disbelief, unbelief, sin, and what we need to be saved from, enlightened, you know, a lack of knowledge, a lack of the truth. And they're standing in this lack of truth, a lack of faith. And her first feeling is it must have been stolen. You know, she's not a crazy person. She's not a fanatic, right? she's like you and me. If we saw an empty tomb, we'd be like, oh man, you killed him and now you've taken his body. Like, this can't get worse. This just can't get worse. I'm going to go tell John. I'm going to go tell Peter. And so she does that. Maybe Peter and John are separated from those. Maybe not. Maybe they're all together, like it says in the other gospels. But for some reason, they're the ones that go. She comes back. She's walking. They're running. She may be filled with, all of her mourning and tears, and just overcome with grief because her Lord is dead. And they've now taken his body. They get there. There's the discussion of how he got there first, but then what they see is what is the big deal.
Mm-hmm. You know, in discussion of who got there first, you know, mostly that was just, I was just joking, but I don't want to gloss over something you said that I've never really picked up on, but I think it's, you know, valuable in a sense that, yes, of course, he does mention twice explicitly and then maybe even four times implicitly that, you know, he's running and he beat Peter there, but he didn't go in first. And I don't necessarily think it's fear. I would very much lean towards, even though he kind of beat Peter, Peter is still going to be a more senior disciple, apostle. I do think there might be some respect there. But even if there's fear, we see Peter, he busts right in, no question. And as someone who, throughout my life, before I became a pastor, I was a private investigator for a while, but I was also in physical security. I worked for a special police firm. I worked at the mall as a security officer for a long time. So I've been in experiences where something happens and it's surprising, and maybe it's an emergency or maybe it's not. And this plays out so real. First person finds it. They don't know what to do. They start speculating. They rush to just anybody. But in this case, she rushes to some friends and certainly spiritual companions and maybe even leaders, of course, right? So she calls them. They run over. They check it out. You know, they run back. She stays behind. this scene as it's unplaying is exactly what would happen if something terribly surprising happened and you don't know what's going on. And ironically, at the same time, I think, and they don't say it, this is complete speculation, but it makes me wonder if they're also maybe running through their head not only who stole Jesus, but, you know, they accused us of doing that, that we would do this very thing, that we would take Jesus's body and claim that he raised from the dead. We find that out in a different place. So, I mean, you know, maybe they're worried about that too, and the witness. There's all kinds of things that we can't even understand what's going through their head. But you're absolutely right. The most important thing is they come there, and it is empty. We are right up against a break, so we're going to take it. But when we come back, I want to hear your thoughts just a little bit, because we did a whole special on this. But I want to hear your thoughts about the linen cloths, of course, and, you know, certain shrouds and places, maybe. So let's talk about that when we get back from the break. Folks, don't go anywhere. Pastor Schenck and I will see you on the other side.
Take a look around you. Look closely. Immigrants in the United States and their U.S.-born children now number about 81 million people, or 26% of the population. So chances are, there's someone right in your community who doesn't speak English as a first language and who doesn't know Jesus. The Lutheran Heritage Foundation can help by providing you with free Lutheran books translated into over 90 languages. See their complete list of catechisms and Bible storybooks at lhfmissions.org.
Welcome back to Thy Strong Word. I'm your host, Pastor Phil Boo. With me today is the Reverend John Schenck. He's the pastor over at Trinity Lutheran Church in Edwardsville, Illinois. And just want to take this time as we're coming back from break to remind you about the email address, thystrongword@kfuo.org. Be sure to shoot me an email, say hi, tell me where you're listening from. Doesn't even have to be a question, but it could. It could be a question, a comment, a complaint, a concern, a compliment, whatever you want to say. Go ahead and say it. And yeah, I'll respond. I mean, you know, I'll respond in kind. So don't be mean. But anyway, send me an email. We'll get you on the show. All right. So let's get back to the tomb here. So we have Peter and John. John outruns Peter, mentions it twice explicitly. Peter gets there. He goes in. It's kind of probably a multi-room tomb here. Typically, it's like an outer chamber and then the inner chamber. It's dark. It's dark outside. They go in. I'm sure there are torches. They see that the body of Jesus is gone, right? And we know that it was bound in linen cloths with the spices according to the burial custom of the Jews. We learned that from the previous chapter. So while we do admit that it was done in haste, it certainly was done properly, or at least to the best that, you know, a couple of old Pharisees could do. They're going to do the good job. So in any way, they put him in this tomb. When they arrive, it says, stooping to look in, he saw the linen cloths lying there, but he didn't go in. So he sees them. So he's seeing through the, either it's just one chamber, or he's seeing all the way through. Peter comes and he sees the linen cloths lying there. And then here's what we get. The face cloth, which had been on Jesus's head, was not lying with the linen cloths, but folded up in a place by itself. Now, correct me if I'm wrong or if you have a different understanding, but I've read in a couple places that the face cloth isn't something that covered his face, but perhaps it was more like something that would have wrapped like under his chin all the way around his head in order to keep the decedent's mouth closed. Do you have any idea about that or anything about the shroud which was over Jesus and why we're being told so many specifics about how it was positioned?
I guess for me, I don't know. I haven't studied about the burial rites of the Jews outside, just having like the same knowledge that most people have about
sure.
Why do they do this? And then what do they do after time has passed. You know, you have you're here in one part of the tomb for a time, and then once some time has passed, a gathering of what remains, and then you can use that part of the tomb again. And then it would, you know, having these wrappings and things would then be beneficial for that practical realities. I thought you were going to ask about the different shroud. It's because
I'm just building a little bridge,
building it up. I guess when it comes to that shroud, I you know, if you look at that shroud, it definitely doesn't seem to fit this depiction.
No,
right?
It doesn't.
I guess I always want I want to believe it's true. I want to believe it's true for the 3D depictions and AI usage and things like that. Or maybe even I want to believe it's true because, you know, if my Lord was wrapped up in these claws, would I just, you know, throw them away? I mean, we don't even treat flags that way. You know, we don't just throw them away. We dispose of them a certain way. And this was used to hold the body of my Lord who was sacrificed for me. So I kind of want to believe that they would say, I'm going to hold on to this and I'm going to be reminded that my Lord was here, but now he is risen.
Not to be contrarian, but once your Lord is risen, do you care about the burial clothes anymore?
I guess we still care about the tomb. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
true, fair.
So at some point it's like, you know, these markers of where Jesus did certain things are still important to us, mm-hmm. you know, that this is the place where, or at least some people say this is the place where he was laid and let's build a church there. And this is the place where our Lord was crucified and let's build a church there. And so I guess in a very practical reality, I see why Christians want to do that because they want to be reminded that this is a historical event. You know, this isn't a fairy tale, and this his real body laid here. So I guess I understand that, but it just doesn't seem to fit the biblical description of that shroud.
So, you know, just 4 days ago, presided over by the Archbishop of Paris and attended by members of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre, the crown of thorns, which adorned Christ's head, was ceremoniously returned to its historic home at Notre Dame. I don't for a minute, I'm sorry, folks, but I don't believe that it was the crown of thorns that adorned Jesus's head. Despite our desire perhaps to save such relics and souvenirs, you know, I think if you know a little bit about anything really, about church history, I think that you're going to find that both of these things and all the, what was it Luther said, there were enough nails from the Holy Cross
yes.
and to shoe every horse in Saxony. So it was such a big business in the Middle Ages that it really kind of taints most of it. But with all that said, I think it does speak to, just as our guest was saying, it does speak to a desire within us to have our faith backed up with concrete evidence. And you know, I don't think that's bad. I think that's how God's designed us. At the same time, faith is very much a virtue and, frankly, very much a gift. You know, who could believe that even Jesus rose from the dead, regardless of how many proofs you had, if you are well aware that generally people don't do that? So you know, I think that God condescends to our need for concreteness in our faith, and that's why he does his means of grace through things like regular water and bread and wine and even the pastor and preaching and fellowship. These things are concrete concrete ways that we express a really ephemeral faith. You know, we can't just really describe faith or draw a picture of faith. So I don't fault people who look to those things, and I don't think that, oh, well, their faith is weak because they're demanding proof. And if they are demanding proof, their faith is weak. But, I mean, I just see it as a natural desire of humans to also kind of say, hey, look, what I believe is reasonable. Again, I don't fault them, but I agree with you. I don't think it's necessarily consistent. But so why are we being told then about this face cloth and this? One thing I read, and maybe this is spot on, I've never really thought about it, I'm just going to be straight up, but if his body was stolen, they would, well, they wouldn't have taken him away naked, right? They would have taken him in his claws.
And you would have taken the time. I mean, if you were stealing and there's these guards out there, you're not going to take the time to fold it up and put it away. Right. You know what I mean? All this is, and there's a lot that we can say about all these details in preaching, right? That the cloth, you know, there's just so much, even with like Luke's gospel, not to draw on another one, but I'm going to break my own little thing. But like, you know, he was wrapped up and laid in a manger. Right. And he's wrapped up and placed in the tomb. And now that need for to take on our own sin, he's done that. Right. There's so much preaching. There's so much homiletical application that we can do here. One part it's that always strikes me and it hit me again, you know, because we talked about the apologetics of it. Right. The apologetics of all these details and the needing of the answer. But it seems like the reality of the empty tomb was not an apologetical proof to them. It was the thing that created the doubt, right? Mm. They've got an empty tomb. The answer is someone stole the body, right? So as much of the proofs are there, the thing that is needed, which then the things that you're talking about, the realities of the sacraments gives to us, we need the physical Christ. The thing that we actually need is the physical Christ in order to believe. And that's what's given to us in the sacraments. That's what's given to us in the preaching. The physical Christ, the risen Christ comes, and that's what they need in order to believe.
You know, that's fascinating to me, and I think it also might speak a little bit to some of our iconographic arguments between each other sometimes, like, say, do you have a corpus on the crucifix, or do you just have a blank cross? You know, why do we wear crosses around our necks instead of, like, little depictions of empty tombs? And, you know, and I don't think it actually, you know, settles any of those issues, but I think it speaks to them in the sense that when we have Christ on the cross, we see Christ. When Christ is off the cross, we have to infer that Christ has resurrected from the dead. And while we believe that, and maybe a blank cross would communicate that, and I think it does in some way, it still takes an extra step. So I like this idea of the reason why we have images of Jesus, whether it be on a cross, a crucifix, or whether it's little baby Jesus in your manger set, you are making images of Jesus. You know, the thing is, are you worshiping those images or God himself? And so, I love this idea that God knows that we're very cathartic people, and he sends us himself in the sacraments, and we, and as you said, they need to see Jesus for faith. And I don't know, maybe I'm taking this step too far, but that's just one of the things that popped in my head.
Yeah, it's a very good thought, right? That what preaches the thing the best, and I would agree with you, having Christ on the cross does a really good job of preaching that Jesus Christ died for you, right? Mm-hmm. Now I'm not going to fight that with I didn't win that at my own church. We got a processional cross, and we were talking about and now it doesn't have a corpus, but I'll wear one with a corpus on it.
At one of my churches, I have to say, we had a processional cross. Well, actually, no, we had an older cross that I personally made into a processional cross by adding a nice pole to it, but it did not have a corpus. And so I said, oh, I'll just order one and put one on there. And with everybody's blessing, mind you. And I didn't really think that through when it arrived. And I'm like, okay, I guess I have to attach the Jesus to the cross now. But thankfully it was with flathead screws, not little nails. So
yeah. And so, you know, that's all we're, you know, as a church and as pastors, it's all we're trying to do. What preaches Christ clearly and rightly? And so when we preach him on a Christmas morning or on an Easter, we want to make it clear who this Christ is and what he has done. So that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, let's move on then. So we have now the disciples go back to their homes or where they were staying in Jerusalem, right? And then verse 11, but Mary stood weeping outside the tomb, and as she wept, she stooped to look into the tomb. and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had lain, one at the head and one at the feet. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Having said this, she turned around and she saw Jesus standing, but she didn't know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" Now, supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she turned and she said to him in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. And Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father, but go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and your God." And Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and that he said these things to her. So that's the end of all of our text for today. It continues with the disciples locked in the room, and that's going to be tomorrow. But so Mary, it seems as though the disciples leave and she stays behind weeping outside the tomb. I suppose it's possible that John is returning to something that happened earlier before she first went to the disciples. Regardless of the chronology, there's a lot of things to unpack here. She sees the angels, they talk to her, Jesus talks to her. What do we make of it?
Yeah, I could understand the timing, but I do think that this is after. There's this back and forth. I'd be willing to be corrected.
This is close to Jerusalem. Them going back and forth is well within the realm of possibility.
And then in that way, if you look at the other gospels, it seems like there is a separation of the women. The women have an encounter with Jesus too. They're going back. She's coming back and she goes back and forth, in my opinion of it. And so she's there, having seen the empty tomb, having seen the stone rolled away, goes to the disciples, just says they have taken my Lord. They go there. Peter comes kind of still with that conclusion. If you look at, you know, Luke 24:24, kind of still comes to that. John has his own conclusion, but it seems to be a kind of like a secretive, maybe he's been raised from the dead, like, but he doesn't tell the rest that in Luke 24:24 until after. So, and then it seems like Peter then has his own encounter with Christ if you take that Emmaus disciples interaction when they come back. So there is many encounters with Christ on that day. So then when she comes back again, maybe they have already left, or maybe they, I don't know. But it seems like now we're just focusing again on Mary herself there, and she's looking in and sees angels. She doesn't have that normal reaction when people see angels, but they talk to her, but they don't yell out, "He's been raised." At this time, they're asking, "Why are you crying?" First interaction isn't telling her about the resurrection. It's Jesus. Jesus gets to be the announcer of the resurrection.
That's a really good point too. Like, why not just sort of relieve her of the burden she's feeling? They ask her why she's crying, but they don't immediately satiate those cries. But no, but yeah, Jesus is the one who does that.
And that's why John's gospel's a little unique, right? Because if the storyline is that way, where she goes, empty tomb, runs back, the women are there staying. They see the angels inside, or angel, then angels inside. "Why are you looking for the living amongst the dead?" And they go back and they're like, they believe it, but for amazement, they don't tell any. They're like, they're just like shell shocked with this knowledge. And then they all kind of come together and then they say more, right? That's how I see it.
When he says Mary, and she turns around and she has a Rabboni, right, in Aramaic. I think it's fascinating because, you know, he calls her by name. And certainly, okay, obviously, that's going to preach. That's easy. But yeah. Sort of on the ground, Jesus says, Mary. I mean, it doesn't say specifically that he was hiding himself or his appearance from her, although he has done that. It's documented. So I wonder in my brain whether or not she is just not recognizing him out of grief until he actually says her name, or Jesus is withholding his identity from her until that moment. I don't know if it actually matters in any way, but it is interesting. Jesus kind of saying, leading her along to, and both the angels too, you know, if you would have listened, essentially, you would not be weeping. You'd be rejoicing. So why are you weeping? Who are you looking for? Kind of like when he says, what did you expect to see when you went out to the wilderness? You know, John, you see him dressed in, you know, nice clothing and soft clothing, which many preachers around the world preach wearing rose pyramids. And I'm in my cassock and surplice talking about, you know, soft clothing. And I'm thinking, oh, this is just about as bad as on Ash Wednesday when we talk about washing our heads. But in any case, So I don't know. Is he leading her to confess something before he reveals it? You know, what is this interaction?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, he is. And it's not just for her now. Like when he asks her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" I really believe that becomes thematic for everyone reading this gospel. Everyone reading this gospel, everyone coming to this moment on an Easter Sunday sunrise service, because that's the reading for the sunrise service, right? Everyone who is coming to church on any Sunday morning, that visitor who's coming and sitting in the pews, who are you seeking, right? What are you here to see? I love that you brought in the whole John the Baptist. It's the same thing. What do you want from God? What are you seeking God in the flesh? Are you seeking to be reconciled to the Father? Are you seeking an answer to death? What are you even here for, Mary? What are you seeking? And then she answers it in her way. What is her problem? I'm seeking the dead body of my friend.
Right.
He ain't dead. That you're seeking the wrong thing. And for all of us, we're seeking the wrong thing until Christ calls us by name. We're seeking something that it's not right. It's only in the word of Jesus that he grabs hold of us and says, that's not what you need. You need this. You need my resurrected body. You need a savior who has brought to fulfillment everything. And that's his answer then. His answer is a fulfillment of everything. It's a fulfillment of everything.
See, I told you you'd preach. No, it's great though, right? I mean, that's exactly it. You know, Jesus calls us by name and we recognize him for who he really is in his call. And I mean, she could have very possibly, I don't like to play that game too much, but she could have very well said, nope, I saw you die and that you can't be him. You're not the real guy. You're an imposter, and run away. And, you know, just to continue the analogy, plenty of people do. Jesus calls them to faith and they say, nope, not what I was expecting or what I was wanting or what fits in with my worldview. So she recognizes him at his word when he calls her by name. And then we get this little confusing part for the last section of our show today. And he says, don't cling to me because I've not yet ascended to the Father. That's a tough one. That's a tough one. Maybe it's not for you. For me, I have a little hard time understanding exactly what he means. Like, don't touch him or don't, you know, hold or grasp onto him because he's still got to ascend. Is there some, I don't know. How do you take it? I've preached it a couple different ways and tried to wrestle with it with my people, but I don't know that I've landed on something really good. Maybe today will be the day. What do you think?
Isn't that something when we look back over our sermons and we disagree with ourselves?
It happens. Like, well, you grow in faith, right?
Yeah. You're like, I don't know if that's really right in that sense. Because it's not like the main thing, right? The main thing isn't how she's clean. It's not like, oh, we disagree about the means of salvation. But what is Jesus really saying here? And I really do like how Dr. Reinwick has talked about it, and I'm sure when his commentary comes out, it'll be very enlightening about this is not the means by which we apprehend. We hold, this is not how salvation is. Us holding, you holding on to me in this garden. You need something more. I am not done in the fullness of salvation for you because I'm going where? I have not yet ascended where? to the Father, but it's not just to the Father, because then he goes on to say, but go tell my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. So that's what he is doing. The ascension is absolutely necessary for our salvation. Apart from the ascension, we cannot be saved. He has to go and take humanity where it was intended to be. And that connects this part of the preaching of the gospel of verse 18, 17 and 18, back to verse 1 of 20, where it's the first day of the week, where all of, so he's not just taking us back to Genesis chapter 1 and leaving us there, Genesis chapter 1, the creation. He's not just recreating us. He is, but he's taking that new creation and bringing it to its end. It's telos. It's, where was it intended to be? It was intended to be at the right hand of the Father, where we will be in the resurrection. We will be there in God's presence, seeing him face to face. That's where he's going, because that's what he has done. And that's now what you have. You don't have, just have me in the garden, Mary. You have me at the right hand of the Father. And he's not just my Father. He's your Father. He's not just my God. He is your God. I've done it. I have saved you, and I have given you, I will be giving you to the Father in my ascension. That's where you need me to go. That's where you need me to go.
You know, and I think something that is missed is that we might focus a little bit on Jesus saying, you know, your God and my God, and then suddenly people want to start taking that apart as if that's a new phrase for Jesus. It's not. I think what's mostly scandalous that Jesus says, that we skim over, is that he literally says to them that God the Father is your Father. Now the Jews would have thought about God as Father, but really only in the sense, if I'm not mistaken, that, you know, he is the Father who created the people, and so he's like the patriarch. But this is very familial in the same way that when Jesus says that he is the Son of God, or God is his Father, to the Jews, and they want to kill him, he's telling us, but, you know, through Mary here, that now, because of what he's doing, God is our Father, not just in a patriarchal kind of, well, he started everything off way, but in a, we can go to him like a dear child goes to their dear father.
What is very personal and natural to Jesus, he is my Father, which is the most scandalous thing, as you said, that Jesus says, this is my Father, very personal. So what they would have been okay with is this collective. He is our Father, right? In the sense of the nation. But he's saying, I am Israel. I am the one. So therefore, he is my Father. But because he is my Father, he's no your Father. And how is that? Because you're my brother. And isn't that the most scandalous thing?
That's right.
That God, through his Son, has reconciled us to himself. That Jesus is actually our brother now. And so he's not like, I'm going to come to them and they are in deep trouble. I'm going to punish. He's, go tell my brothers this, that now, because they're my brother, they have my Father as their Father. The fullness of the reconciliation, fullness of this whole redeeming act, has brought to completion all that God ever wanted for us. And all that God ever wanted for us is to be united to us. And we see it perfectly in our Emmanuel, God with us, right? It is just, it's a perfect text. To be connecting us now to the resurrection, but for us as we look ahead to the birth of Christ and to celebrating this one who was born for us, has brought about the fullness of what God ever wanted for us. He did it through his Son.
Well, I think that's a wonderful way to end our lesson today, and that's exactly what we're going to do. I'd like to thank my guest, the Reverend John Schenck. He's the pastor of Trinity Lutheran Church in Edwardsville, Illinois. Thank you, brother, for being on the show.
Well, thank you, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you. All right. Doubt, fear, locked doors. These are the marks of the disciples after this event that we talk about today. Of course, that is until Jesus enters the room. When we cover the rest of John 20 tomorrow with Pastor Jacob Herkamp, we're going to witness the risen Christ bringing peace to those who are fearful, commissioning even those who are uncertain, but of course offering tangible proof to folks like Thomas who are unbelieving. those who demand to see and touch, he gives them that, but he also points them to something greater. The confession that Thomas will make when he says, "My Lord and my God." So all of that and a lot more is going to be discussed tomorrow. So I hope you join us for that. But until then, may God's peace and blessings be with all of you as we pray together. Father, keep us in thy strong word.